Welcome to Hollywood Wolfpack with Kaya Alexander, featuring in-depth interviews and insights with professionals in the entertainment business. Get everything you need to navigate your above-the-line career right here. This podcast is often recorded live in front of Kaya students in the Entertainment Business School. You can find out more at entertainmentbusinessschool.com. Hollywood Wolfpack is the new face of entertainment business wisdom. Enjoy the show.
All right. Hey, everybody, and welcome to Hollywood Wolfpack. I'm your host. I'm Kaya Alexander, here today with my special guest, Matthew Medney. I'm excited for you to meet him and tell you all about him. He's the co-founder, CEO, and co-lead creative of boutique storytelling company and Hero Projects. He's also the former CEO of the generational and legendary heavy metal magazine. Matthew spends most of his time thinking about the unknown. As a graduate of the University of Massachusetts at Amherst's Eisenberg School of Management, Matthew started his career in the live event space, operating as a tour and production manager, traveling across 45 countries, producing over 300 shows for concerts like Coachella, Ultra Music Festival, Electric Daisy Carnival, and Lollapalooza, alongside artists like Knife Party, Cheat Codes, Kazo, and more. He's authored several best-selling works, such as his hard sci-fi novel, Beyond Kuiper. I hope I said that right, Matthew. The Galactic Star Alliance Above the Ground, and the graphic novel Darkwing. In addition, he has penned multiple comic books, including The Red, Stable, and Remnant. Other notable graphic works Medney has helmed includes works in collaboration with bands and music festivals, such as the number one hip hop festival in the world, Rolling Loud, Grammy award-winning musician Shaggy, along with other notable talents such as Floyd Mayweather Jr., Nightmare Kid, Insomniac's Events, Disney, and the NFL. Welcome, Matthew.
How you doing, Kaya?
Oh my God, that was like my IQ test for the day, was reading your bio. It's all...
It was a little long. I apologize. I know you said 100 words, and as you were reading, I was like, this is definitely more than 100 words.
I always warn my guests, if you give me a longer bio, you're the one who has to sit through it. So
yes, it's definitely a unique way of torture, for sure.
How does it feel, though, having your accomplishments read back to you? How does it feel sitting on the receiving end of that?
Out of body experience.
Really?
It's a little strange. Yeah, because, you know, when you're working on some of those things, you don't necessarily contextualize all of it. And even when you're reading it on paper, you don't necessarily contextualize it all. So when you hear it, it's a bit strange because, you know, working with, you know, Floyd, for instance, it was really important to him to share a story about, like, his life, because obviously in the press there's a lot of controversy around his literacy and his focus on boxing versus his ability to read, and I know that's been something that was played in the trades a lot, in the tabloids, and Floyd was really passionate about wanting to explain to the world that, like, he had one option to help his family, which was to box, and being able to, like, tell that story was really visceral, and that's what that comic book and graphic novel is about. And, you know, when you get into the details of somebody's life like that, you sort of remove the celebrity that they are, and you focus on the story that you're trying to tell. So hearing it back it's definitely a different modality than I think about it when I say it to myself.
When talking about that project, which sounds really close to your heart, how did that come about?
During the NFT boom in the 2021, Floyd was doing a project where he had sold out, I believe it was 15,000 keys to a Floyd Mayweather project, and he and his team were looking for ways to add value to that project. And we had gotten connected through an intermediary, and we had discussed creating this sort of life story of Floyd for those 15,000 holders, that they would be able to get an inside look to what has made Floyd who he is today, and why he's so, you know, verbose and loud and proud today, and what sort of came about in his early days that shaped that. And that was sort of how that came about. And, you know, it's always interesting to see how athletes and creatives and celebrities paths have gone, because there's always a thread of wanting to prove somebody wrong from early in their life. It's pretty tropey with almost everyone, is that there's a moment that they latch onto, whether that moment is perceived by them or actually real. They use that as fuel to become who they become, and distilling that in a story was really fun, because again, he's the most decorated boxer of all time, so to see how he actually ticks firsthand was really special.
That's so cool. How did that collaboration go? Were you working with him? Were you working with his team? Were there a lot of decision makers, or did it ultimately come down to the two of you?
There's a lot of decision makers. We worked a couple of times on a Zoom, but mostly through his team. There were a ton of interviews and literature that he had done in the past that we got as source material. And then we sort of crafted this story of this hero's journey, really, at the end of the day, of, you know, 9 siblings living in a 1-bedroom apartment and him seeing boxing as the way out.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I know what a creative you are. And when you have that much abundance of story, how did you find the spine, the through line, what you wanted to focus on?
I think it's always better to have more, right? An ice sculpture isn't sculpted from a thin piece of ice. So the more data, the more fat you have, the easier it'll be to find the meat. And until if you don't have enough, the thing is, when you're creating a story, fictional or non-fictional, the spark will come from a single sentence, a word, a random piece that might not ever actually make it into the final bit. But if you don't have a wide array of data points to consume, it'll be really hard to distill the essence of what you're trying to say. Because Ben Franklin, you know, said, if I had more time, I'd write a shorter letter. And, that is like the impetus for all writing, is you want to get all of the information and then find a way to distill it in the shortest amount of time. I write a weekly newsletter called The Writer's Take on Substack. And in my first Writer's Take, I showed my method. I call it the funnel down method, where you take a 200 word description of your story and you whittle it down to one word. And by being able to do that, you can like master the idea of what you're trying to say. Similarly with how I try to write the last sentence of every book I write first, because it's really a lot easier to reverse engineer stories than it is to engineer. And if you have the foresight of where you're going to take the journey, it's much easier to write a better adventure.
Oh, I love that. So Matthew and I met at the Creative Vision Sundowner party. Maybe it was like a month or two ago. And yeah. You and I, it was so much fun meeting you, meeting your dad, your amazing dad.
Yeah, he's the legend that inspired me to be the creative, right? Having designed Happy Meal toys in the 90s for KFC, running brand partnerships with Nabisco. And then, you know, in my opinion, the most genius was if anyone has a pet, a dog or a cat, microchipping them, you know, is really important, because they can run away and they can get lost. And in the early 2000s, microchipping was a fraction of the animals. It was really misunderstood. People didn't understand what it was. And it was my dad's vision to take Snoopy and that brand and use that as a equity partner to Home Again, which is the leading microchipping company, to make it feel safe for the pet owner. And that sort of a vision on story and narrative and ideas is sort of where I got the idea. Got the inspiration to be an author, because as you said in the bio, I started off in torn production management, so I was always telling stories, but I was telling stories on stage with pyrotechnics and confetti and cryo guns and all those things. And it was on the road I wrote my first novel. And it was actually for 2 years, I wrote an outline and was interviewing ghostwriters because I had never written, 95,000 words before. So I didn't think I had the right to write 95,000 words. And then I interviewed a bunch of ghostwriters for a couple of years, and none of them felt like they were nailing the creative that I was going for. And then my co-creator, John, who's an amazing, not just creative, but a scientist. He's a astrophysicist for Lockheed and works on the celestial ground support lead deep space division, basically making sure things like the helicopter on Mars actually can fly in 1/100th atmosphere. And I can go down science rabbit hole, so I'll try not to. But he had sent me a clip of a Carl Sagan interview, and it just inspired me to be like, I know how this book starts now. And then we were just, and that was in 2017. We were like, screw it, let's try to write it. And and then we wrote it, and it did its thing on Amazon. It's done very well, which has been a blessing, and that's sort of given me the confidence to write a lot more. And then
which book was that?
Jan Kuiper.
It's unusual that your first novel does so well. Did you have anything in mind in particular with your marketing, or was it all word of mouth?
So when we wrote it, when we started writing it in 2017, the movie Gravity had just come out, and we both watched the review where Neil deGrasse Tyson eviscerated it for its lack of science. And both of us had said, if we only ever sell one copy of this book, it needs to be as science accurate as any science fiction novel has ever been. That was just our impetus from day one. So, I mean, we're writing the second book now. It's taken us 4 years because we are ruthlessly critical about the science.
Oh, I love it.
So with the first book, when it started getting reviews, we at the time I was, in all transparency, I was the CEO of Heavy Metal Magazine, which gave me gravitas and maybe more resources than others, just because of the role. I was able to get some reviews, and the reviews came in really kindly. Screen Rant had said it was the most realistic design of a spaceship ever conceived in literature, which was obviously great. So we've seen a lot of success with the science engineer community, who reads a lot of science fiction.
I'm down here at UCSD, right? I'm in San Diego, and within our family is Professor Brian Keating.
I love Keating. I didn't know that. I listen to his podcast all the time.
Keating is a good friend. Into the Impossible. You're an Into the Impossible fan.
I listen to him. I listen to Lex Friedman. I listen to Huberman. All of those guys.
Yeah, all those guys. Yeah, they've been building the giant new telescope down in Chile, and
totally.
Keating's been in our community for about 5.5 years while my son's dad has been working with him at the university as they've been building this telescope and rolling it out. And it's been really fun to see my son running through the labs and growing up watching this telescope get built out of really surprising ingredients, sometimes like Play-Doh in order to put pieces together. It's just like super wild. That's fun.
It's the 2023 version of the movie Contact.
Right. Well, we don't know. We're hoping that he finds out the origin of the universe, when they get first light on that telescope, I believe next year.
That would be amazing. I'm most excited for the Jupiter missions in 2026, I think it is. Because it's very possible that there's life on Titan and Europa. It could be really, really cool to see. But we wrote the book, and we got these reviews, and then the marketing strategy was not crazy. I wish we probably had done more. we got lucky that it had done as well as it did, because we released it in November of 2020. So the ability oh, wow. to do book tours non-existent. So we had done a bunch of Zoom book tours, which don't really hit the same way, but we we did the best we could on it. And then we were able to do a bunch of media reviews and things like that, and a couple of promotions. There's a book newsletter called BookBub that does really great promotion.
You have to be selected to be promoted through them. It's not something that you can just, you know, sign up for. So
exactly. Yeah. So all of my books have typically gotten BookBub reviews and all that stuff. So that's been very helpful. Publishers Weekly had done it's called Books on Tap, where they do like an interview styled review of the book, which went very well. And then Comic-Con had orchestrated a panel for us with a biologist to grill us on the etymology of the various species. Because when I say that we were very science heavy, I mean, even to the detail of the mass density, moon composition, radius to the sun, type of sun would dictate the type of life that was on that planet. So we were really granular with it, which is why writing the sequels are really, really difficult, because we have to make sure we don't break canon. And we even mapped the galaxy with 600,000 planets and different sectors and stargates and a lot of over-needed exuberance. But it was more for us than it was for anyone else. And I think that's what resonated.
That's so great. Love it. When you get to San Diego, we'll have to introduce you to some friends. David Brin is also my neighbor.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. I don't need much convincing to come down to the Gaslamp District, because I love the food down there. Yeah. It is amazing. But yeah, that sounds great. We'll definitely have to coordinate that.
This is so cool. See, I didn't even know all of this about you, because when we were at the party, I felt like we were talking to Dad.
Yes.
Getting Dad's origin story, and you get the two of you together. Oh my God, just light up. Guy, so great. And then I think you had been talking about NFL, which is a little bit buried in your bio. Let's talk about that and how that brand relationship came about and what you've been doing with them. It's really interesting.
Yeah. So I'm not sure what I can say publicly yet, but yeah. I can say that we are doing I think it is a national campaign, obviously with a comic. I believe on September 19th, there will be a press conference about it, which would be really exciting. So we can do a follow-up if you want on it.
That'd be great. Is it part about, is it about literacy? I was trying to remember.
No. So it is in like a grand sort of construct. As anyone that follows the NFL knows, they do a lot of stuff in the community with the local hospitals. They have tackle cancer, Place 60, all of their health initiatives. And this is within the line of the stuff that they do with their health initiatives.
Yeah, that's what I had learned from you. You had mentioned how much they do for communities around health, and I wasn't aware of that. I think you said they do more than any other sports league, yeah?
More than any other sports league with all the athletes. There is an award that's almost more coveted every year by NFL players than MVP, which is the Walter Payton Award. And the Walter Payton Award is given to the player in the league who does the most for the community during that season. The player that's able to balance giving back to the community with the grueling nature of a full NFL season, the Walter Payton Award is sort of like the highest of honors for the individual players. And that perpetuates these various activations in the different communities around health awareness, kids needing to be more active and less on their mobile devices and things like that, right? Because, you know, as much as a vast amount of the stories I write are about AI, technology, the future, most of the time my personal view is that technology should be held until like 15, because it really stunts the growth of kids. Creativity comes from a lack of resources, not from an abundance of resources. And when, you know, the best movies that have ever been made are the ones that that have a small budget, and the directors and actors have to be inspired to find the solution. The biggest example of that is Jaws. So Spielberg's first film, right? Spielberg's first big film. They're a day away from filming, and the mechanical shark breaks. Doesn't have a shark. Doesn't have the budget to remake the shark. And John Williams comes in the room and talks to Steven and says, "You don't need to see the shark. You need to feel the shark." And that's when you got the bum bum and the bum bum and the audio cue that a shark was coming. With the fin, right? The fin is being held up literally by a scuba diver underneath because they did not have the mechanical shark working. Now, imagine if they had the budget and they fixed it. Wouldn't be the same movie. Right. It would be like Meg, like this travesty that is Meg. It's the fear of the unknown that creates the suspense. But to get to that point, you need to be put in situations where the elasticity is near breaking and you find a way to see it through. And that's just hard to do when resources are abundant. And I think that principle coincides with the development of our youth. And we need to be more cognizant about how we're developing brains, that we have Huberman has all of this amazing research about how much later in life brain development actually occurs. And it's not just in the youth, and we're stunting things even younger. So thinking about it contextually like that, I think, is really important too.
I completely agree with you. You know, I'm a mom. I have an 11-year-old, and the pandemic was really tough because he's an only child. So it was like all the schools moved to online. They all moved to iPads. The only way for him to socialize was to get on Roblox, play video games. And after watching what happened to him over those 2 years, I took them all away. I was like, nope, you need to do art. You need to read books. You need to write stories. And like it absolutely supported him, transformed him. He's so engaged in sports. He loves reading books. He's so creative. He draws for hours. And it was so undeniable, the difference in his happiness, his joy levels, his depression, anxiety start to fade away, all for the creativity, all for the organic creativity and being outside and breathing fresh air. And I was like, I don't know if I'm ever going to give you the video games back. I know all your friends play them. I know it's fun, but it's just been such a better life for him. You know, I sound like an old, right? Because I'm like, oh, I'm such a Gen Xer. I was like, go get on your bike. We didn't even have helmets.
Well, I think, you know, we forget as a society history quite quickly. And, you know, in the current construct of the world, and very much America more than anything else, because Europe's actually really great with this, the lack of arts being subsidized and held up, almost every major empire to ever exist heralded the arts as a sacred right that needed to be nurtured. Even Europe now, you know, these huge classical performances happen in mega stadiums, not because they can sell them out or because the finances make sense. It's because the European Union subsidizes all of those events, because there's a sometimes the need to make money is not the only reason to do something. And I think we've lost track of that, specifically with the arts. And that's why some of these more important artistic expressions have downgraded in the size of venues they can do. Whereas in other parts of the world, the governments just say, no, this is important to our culture. Let's figure out a way to do it. So I actually agree with everything you're saying when it comes to being outside and experiencing nature. And, you know, it is not having a cell phone causing anxiety for a parent that needs to get in touch with their kid? Maybe. But I remember as a kid not being able to reach a parent when I needed something, and I figured out how to do it. And that life skill is undeniably important, of being able to understand how to just like figure things out
Situational awareness of that as well, even just for safety, just walking through the world and seeing, hey, what's happening around you. It's been fun watching my son engage with waiters and, you know, wait staff and all kinds of folks just in and around the world. He knows how to advocate for himself. He knows how to talk to anybody. And, you know, there's a lot of joy in seeing that because he's not just interacting with a device, a phone, a screen, you know, and doesn't know how to talk to a human being. I'm always trying to put the human back in.
We have this,
and you know, even in my own family, I want to ask you, because you give advice to writers and my students who are with us live today on our call, we've been doing pitching. We've been working on pitching. We've been practicing pitching. We just had their big practice session pitching yesterday. And I'm wondering if you have advice for pitching for my audience who are a lot of writers and also for the students who are in the school.
Yeah. So when it comes to pitching for me, I always say, prepare, don't practice. Never, at least from my point of view, never recite the things that you're going to say in the pitch. Don't try to like look in the mirror and read a script and memorize that script. Prepare, learn the facts of the playing field. Think of it like a sporting game. You practice plays and you watch tape, but then everything is audible on the field once you see what sort of feedback you're getting. I think a lot of people fall into the trap of trying to memorize their pitch, and then if the person receiving it asks a question or you forget a word and you stumble and you forget something, it's a lot harder to keep tracked if you realize in your head that you missed something that you had practiced than if you just have a wide array of tools in your toolbox that you can reach for in the moment.
Oh yeah, that makes so much sense. I love the sports analogy for pitching, where you do get out there and see what happens, you know, live and in the moment with what your the drills that you've done.
Yes,
you know what to
exactly.
Draw from, and then you can be playful in the moment because things can change in real time.
Yeah, and then to just add to that is I don't think if you go into a pitch thinking that you're pitching, you've lost. You need to go into the pitch and think that you're having a conversation with someone that's interested in your idea. If you think of it more than a conversation, A, you're going to psych yourself out, which is just going to be felt by the person you're pitching to. I've been on both sides of this conversation, and it's very obvious when somebody is nervous, and sometimes nerves can be perceived as not confident in the idea. So it is always better to come in and be conversational and don't go 15, 20 minutes straight. And this point that I'm about to make is contrarian to what you'll hear a lot of places, but be on the offense, not on the defense. Another sports analogy, ask questions to the person that you're pitching to early. Don't just make them sit through a 15, 20 minute pitch. Do a 5-minute introduction, ask them a question, get them engaged, because you know, if you get someone engaged in a 30 minute conversation and you talk about the product for 5 of those minutes, there's a much better chance of them actually reading the take home materials than there is if you pitch them, because the reality is no one's listening to the pitch. I'm just going to break it to you. They're going to sit there. They're going to hear sounds. They're going to smile. They might pick up on one or two words, and then they're going to give your leave back materials to their assistant to read, to write a coverage on it. And then they're going to read that coverage, and then they're going to make a decision if they liked you and if they liked the coverage to have a second meeting. And then that second meeting is where they're going to actually pay attention. So if you go into it with that perspective, it should always be, how do we get to the second meeting where you're going to pay attention? And that's by humanizing the first conversation.
Yeah, I love that. It's so important to make the connection. I teach that within the pitching, like make a human connection, find out what you have in common, more than just like the traffic on the 405, which was a classic mistake, right? I was a development exec back in the early aughts, and it was always like the small talk of, you know, somebody who's really nervous in front of you, who's going to, you know, talk like crazy about this thing they hope that you'll buy. And, you know, it was often awkward, and you just don't buy those pitches. You just kind of go, yeah, you know, this was just dull or confusing, and it didn't feel like we want to be friends. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, it didn't feel like, hey, I want to actually see this person again. Like, I'm going to be excited when we, you know, get to make your movie. I'll be happy to see you, you know?
Exactly. I mean, you don't need to become best friends with the people that you do work with, but I am a firm believer that if you are not working with people who you want to go have drinks with, have dinner with, on the company, on your own dollar, whatever. If you're not in the business to do that, then you should go be an accountant. Because like this business is uniquely positioned where the work friends can be really fun, and you should embrace that. And it is the only industry in the world in which work friends can actually be like really great friends. You have to keep that veneer of professionalism, and you have to ensure that the friendship is going both ways, that you're not always asking and you're not always taking, but you're giving. And if you follow those rules, then, you know, when you pitch or when you have these conversations, that comes across, that sort of bubbly, authentic reality of, we're going to make this movie, or we're going to develop this movie, but we're also going to go have fun at Casinori and go to the Dodgers game and be able to, you know, exchange gifts during the holidays and have this really great relationship that goes beyond just the work. And that is unique to entertainment. And people misconstrued that with becoming best friends. And I've made that mistake before. I mean, you know, I can only talk like this because I've made many, many mistakes. Let's be very, very clear about that. but the reality is you want to appreciate that this industry in the arts and the creative space allows for cool, amazing office relationships that other industries don't sort of induce. And that should be very much coveted.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I like to use the analogy of the solar system. So if you're the sun and you have these relationships, it's unusual that we have this really social business, and you might have relationships that get as close to you as like Saturn, Earth, you know, they're orbiting kind of close. Don't let them be Mercury. That's your spouse. That's your kids, you know, like don't let them in that far, but they come close enough that you're like, hey, this is, we have fun together. You know, I'm going to see you at that next event. I'm going to see you at that, you know, at the film festival. I'm going to support your movie, your show. And, you know, you see these faces again and again, and you can celebrate your wins and also talk about your losses, and you have people to share it with. The title of my show, the name of my show is Hollywood Wolfpack. I always ask my guests, who's in your wolf pack? So this is your question, Matt. Who's in your wolf pack?
My team at Hero, Voodoo Bones, who's Pete Russo, Johnny Handler, and Morgan Rosenblum. We started Hero 9 years ago. You know, and did our first comic was for Live Nation, and our most recent one has been with the NFL, and we've been through thick and thin together, and that's been incredible. And, you know, one of the things that I like to always say about the people that are close to you, your wolf pack, is it's really easy to be friends and in good times when things are going well. It's really hard when there are failures and when there are issues. And the real wolf packs are the people that are there in the bad times, not the people that are there in the good times. The good times are really easy to have a lot of people there. And then my quote-unquote new wolf pack is my team. We had announced about a month and a half ago my new creative company called Iconic Arts. Stephen Hadidian, Mo Yadizi, Alec Roth, and Jack Sheehan. And we're forming this transmedia studio that is going to do some pretty special things. And with them as well, we've been through a lot already. And it's important to understand that when you have people that are close to you, that if they're to always keep every keep a proverbial ledger. It's really easy, especially in this industry as well, for people to latch on and to suck you dry like a vampire. And those people might act like they're in your wolf pack, but those are the people that disappear when the sun comes up. And it's important to keep note of that and to shed them as needed and make that wolf pack as tight as possible. And the best piece of advice on that is never feel sorrow for the people that you have to cut. Obviously, it's going to be painful because we're all like humans with emotions. But the reality is, if somebody needs to be cut, it's probably because they have sucked a lot of your energy without giving you anything. And yes. You do have to remember how to take care of yourself as well, which is also very hard to do in this industry.
Or in a worst case scenario, maybe they broke trust. You know, you've got to let people go. And there's at some point the audition has to be over and you have to know if they're adding value or not. You've got to really take an honest look at that. Congratulations about Iconic Arts. Transmedia, tell me all about it. I'm fascinated by this area of the entertainment business.
Yeah, so we believe at Iconic Arts that every story that we put out is going to be a franchise, and not necessarily a franchise from the point of view of multiple films, but a franchise from the point of view of different mediums. So everything that we're investing in and building and creating will have multiple entry points, be it a video game, a book series, a TV show, a film, toys. We're really looking at sort of the Gen Xers and the new way in which media is consumed via TikTok and social media, and trying to find avenues in that don't just feel traditional, but feel new and can create as much product recognition as a classic film can. But we believe that doing IP from the point of view of what feels best for that IP first, and then building content around it that is not repetitive but additive. It is unfortunate when you get brands that make a film that's based off a book that is the same video game that has the same toy, because studios, as you know probably even better than I do, are so scared of making a mistake that they don't do the correct thing.
They don't talk to each other. They're like all the same thing in a different form, like cookie cutter in a way. And it sounds like you're thinking about the relationships that these things can have in their different medium to one another. Is that right?
100%. And another point of view of this, that's what does Lost, Game of Thrones, and Harry Potter all have in common? They have one thing in common that is why they were so elevated. And it's the thing that we think a lot about at Iconic, is they all killed off characters that they put a lot of time and equity into. And fans, people that consume, enjoy that, because if everyone lives, there's no stakes. Right. If there's no stakes, it's not real, right?
Nobody's gonna die.
Right. If nobody's gonna die, then what are we doing here? So when I hope I'm not spoiling any Harry Potter stuff, because it's like a 25-year-old property now. But when they killed Sirius Black, it created real stakes, right? When in book 5 he dies, you're like, oh snap, this is crazy, because I only met him a book and a half ago, and I love this character, and what's going to happen to Harry now? And, you know, I always say that the genius of J.K. Rowling and the Harry Potter series is that if you give any 11-year-old the Sorcerer's Stone and tell them to read one book a year as they turn the next year, and they are the ages of Harry, Ron, and Hermione, each book ups the ante of life lessons for that age group perfectly. It is a perfect journey of life lessons from an 11 to an 18-year-old, and that's the way that she wrote it. And those books, you know, book 5, so if you're 16, the death of a loved one is something that you can really contextualize. A lot of my friends, a lot of people I know had grandparents that passed away around that age range, and being able to read that and see how that was internalized and contextualized is probably helpful to a lot of people. And that was like the theology that she came with the books, is that each of the books is that age year's life lessons. And I thought that that's just genius, in my opinion.
Oh, I love the way that you frame that. That's just so fascinating for the legacy and over the course of time and growth and everything. It's just really interesting. So it sounds like you're thinking that way for your company and about your project, and how will the age, the intentionality around what happens over the course of the timeline?
Yeah, I always say that one of the big things for Iconic is that, again, another term that you probably know very well, a cradle to grave, which yes. means, an IP.
I
should,
prefer cradle to cradle, but I'll take cradle to
grave. Cradle to grave, or four quadrant, or eight quadrant now, depending on who you're talking to. And my philosophy, because I'm going to be sitting as the chief creative officer for Iconic, is the company, the brand Iconic, can be cradle to grave or four or eight quadrant, but that does not mean that every IP needs to be. Is that within the family of franchises, we should have franchises that adhere to kids, YA, teens, young adults, and adults. And we should have that spectrum for people to choose from and to be able to grow with the company and have an IP that they can latch onto as they grow up, kind of the same way that Rowling did the different years in the books. But if you try to make a singular product attract everyone, it's going to attract no one. Sure. Right? That's just like, no matter how many times people like to use the buzz phrase of four quadrant or eight quadrant. I mean, I don't know if I would show Raiders of the Lost Ark to an eight-year-old, but I would show the Dial of Destiny to an eight-year-old. And that's why Dial of Destiny didn't do that well, because it tried to... be something for everyone versus being something for someone. And it's really important when you're creating to not listen to the executives. If I'm going to tell you one area to push back on, it is just make sure they understand that things do not need to be four quadrant. First off, it's like such a misnomer. If something's made for an 18-year-old, but it toes the line, it does not have, gruesome sex or crazy killing, if it toes the line like Archie does, the 18-year-old will enjoy it and the 11-year-old will aspire to love it because they want to be cool like the 18-year-old. And that's why Archie is such a major hit, because there's this this tightrope, this fine line of being able to create IP that's aspirational but also relevant. And when you can find that middle ground, you get the Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, you get Rivendell, you get Wednesday, you get Stranger Things. Those are all hitting that middle point of being just edgy enough for adults and young adults to like it, and just curbed enough that the kids can enjoy it too.
Yeah, I think you're even pointing to the success of something like The Simpsons.
100%. But they're time travelers, because how do you think, like, I don't even think they're human. I don't know how they are so, I mean, how do you do an episode in 1994 about Donald Trump winning the election because he got made fun of by a former president? Like, what? Like, how does that happen? There's been, I don't know how many of you guys that are listening know this, but Google like the things that The Simpsons have gotten right, and it is insane. From like, I mean, literally, there's an episode of The Simpsons in 1994 where Donald Trump becomes president. Amazing. Crazy.
I didn't even know that.
And that's one of like 20 different moments that they have predicted over the course of the running of that show. So it is a wild reality, but they are also a perfect example. On the upper end would be South Park, right? That's for adults.
Yeah.
You can't necessarily show that to kids.
Of course, no kidding. Okay, I got one more question for you. And I know we're in the midst of the strikes right now, so it's a little bit like, okay, imagine the post-strike world. How are you making your decisions about what to invest in around the IP that you're excited about with your company?
Yeah, I think one of the advantages that we have about thinking the way that we do timeless franchise, on bigger picture IPs, is that we're not trying to invest in stories that are good for the moment. So if our IPs are not good for a year from now, 6 months from now, 10 years from now, then we shouldn't be investing in it anyway. So even though the strike is crazy, and you know, obviously, to just put my two cents in, I don't understand how studios can't parse bad decision making on deciding to invest in all of this technology with them making money on the individual IP. Those two things are being clouded as an individual profit and loss line, whereas the money invested in creating their streaming service and the losses they're taking on that should not have any bearing to the success of the individual content that the creatives are making. And they are meshing those two things as one. And I think once those get thought of properly, you'd be able to have better conversations, but unfortunately, you can't. Justine Bateman, actually, and I'll just end with this, had an amazing point of view on why we're where we are. In 2000, when the tech dot-com boom occurred, and everyone had their dot-coms, people invented the term content. That term had not existed before, and content was just a tool used to bring people to their website for the Google ad money.
Yes.
And then in the 2010s, a bunch of the tech companies bought all the studios. So now we're in a position where these companies who, for their entire existence, have looked at creative, which they now call content, which is not the same thing as what we make, as just a tool to get people on their website. So you have the creatives who look at their soul in these projects, and these now tech companies looking at these projects as content to create revenue. And that's where the heads are mashing. That is the core essence of the conflict. And that needs to be reconciled in some way, shape, or form before anyone can move forward. All the other things that you read about with the AI and the this and the that are all secondary to that one core ideological difference on how they view the movies and shows that are going on the platforms.
Oh yeah, it's true and fascinating, and I hope we all come out on top, for the strikes, for everything everyone is standing for and taking a stand for right now, which is so imperative for creatives and for everything in this industry that matters to us, the stories that we care about telling the way we care about telling them.
Yeah, 100% agree.
You've been an incredible special guest. I have had so many laughs with you. I really appreciate you being here with us. How can people find you and follow you, especially your newsletter?
Yeah, so it's at Matthew Medney, MatthewMedney, at Instagram and Twitter, though I'm really bad at Twitter. I post more on Instagram. The Writer's Take, which is, I think it's substack.com/The Writer's Take. And that comes out every Wednesday morning or midday, depending on how the day's going. And then you can follow Hero Projects at heroprojects.io and iconicarts.com.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Hollywood Wolfpack. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Please help our pack grow by sharing Hollywood Wolfpack with your friends and colleagues. Give us a rating and write us a review. Kaya loves hearing from you and reads them all. For more on Kaya and the Entertainment Business School, visit entertainmentbusinessleague.com. Until next week, remember, the strength of the pack is the wolf, and the strength of the wolf is the pack.